I'm going to introduce our ritual this morning in more fully than I have been before we start singing. The ritual of stones and water that we have taken on during the gathering hymn or gathering music incorporates earth elements during the marking of our joys and sorrows by placing stones in a bowl of water, as well as during the lighting and extinguishing of the chalice. In addition to making this ritual more accessible to all, regardless of age or ability, the placement of stones in water completes the elemental wheel of earth, water, air, and fire. The element of water is essential to all life. It may symbolize the healing tears of love, compassionate understanding, purification, repose or change, the passage of time, and the transcendence of earthly conditions. The element of earth, represented by the stones, is a container and maintainer of life. As matter, the stones ground and stabilize us. These stones can symbolize humility, forgiveness, practicality, wisdom, and eternity. During the gathering hymn, you are invited to come forward and place a stone representing your sorrows or joys into one of the bowls of water. Tomorrow, as you know, is a federal holiday, one that is observed in Virginia, and what we have known as Columbus Day since its being designated as a federal holiday in 1937 was not fixed to the second Monday in October until 1970. 24 states, at least, nearly one half of the country, do not observe this problematic holiday. In a movement to appropriate Columbus Day as Indigenous Peoples Day, some states, such as South Dakota, Alabama, Hawaii, and Alaska, and many more cities, have renamed the holiday. Although there is not a unified name, most change the focus to honoring the prior inhabitants of the North American continent. And as we heard in the poem that Kristen read this morning, Christopher Columbus's so-called discovery of the Americas has always been rather misrepresented, shall we say. We are a nation of immigrants that have overrun the land, conquering and colonizing every inch of its vastness. The doctrine of discovery, under which Christopher Columbus was operating, has its origins in the 1455 papal bull Romanus Pontifex, which approved Portugal's claims to lands discovered along the coast of West Africa. And in another one, the Inter Ceteria, written in 1493, which ratified Spain's right to conquer newly found lands after Christopher Columbus had already begun doing so. European monarchies felt entitled to lay claim to any land they set foot upon. Those without the privilege of owning property in the old country were utilized through surveying and settlement to seize lands inhabited by indigenous peoples under the guise of discovery. The late 19th century Jewish poet Emma Lazarus wrote 1492 as a sequel to her sonnet, The New Colossus, the poem affixed to the pediment of the Statue of Liberty, for which she is most famous, and which you just heard a musical rendition of. In 1492, she links Columbus's discovery of a new world of refuge with the expulsion of Jews from Spain, providing a pretext for the new Colossus. Here's the poem. Thou two-faced year, mother of change and fate, didst weep when Spain cast forth with flaming sword the children of the prophets of the Lord. Prince, priest, and people, spurned by zealot hate, hounded from sea to sea, from state to state. The West refused them, and the East abhorred. No anchorage the known world could afford. Close locked was every port, barred every gate. Then smiling, thou unveilest, O two-faced year, a virgin world where doors of sunset part, saying, ho, all who weary enter here. There falls each ancient barrier that the art of race or creed or rank devised to rear grim bulwarked hatred between heart and heart. She pulls no punches. In this new virgin world, those who have been cast out because of their race, ethnicity, or religion may find refuge from zealous hatred, religious persecution, and economic oppression. Lazarus' poem was written at a time when Jews were emigrating from Russia to escape pogroms intended to cast forth the children of the prophets of the Lord, to hound them from the Russian state. As Esther Shore writes in a fascinating biography of Emma Lazarus, perhaps not since the Puritans envisioned New England as a new Jerusalem was there as compelling a vision of the spiritual destiny of the nation. Shore continues, because this sonnet limits its gaze to the year 1492, a developed vision of that land lies beyond its purview. But its parting glimpse leaves us in some perplexity. Is it truly a virgin world of open doors? Or is it a place where bulwarks of race or creed or rank must be leveled in order for its promise to be realized? Bulwarks erected by whom? And leveled by whom? Lazarus had, by 1883, when she wrote The New Colossus, been campaigning for about 18 months on behalf of Russian Jews. In December 1881, Ward's Island at the northern end of the East River, home to an asylum, a charity hospital, and a dump, had become a shelter for Russian Jewish refugees when the capacity at Castle Garden in Brooklyn was exceeded. Lazarus visited those refugees in the spring of 1882. She wrote several poems that year, including In Exile, that takes as its inspiration an extract from a letter sent by a Russian refugee living in Texas. That refugee wrote, "Since that day till now, our life is one unbroken paradise. We live a truly brotherly life. Every evening after supper, we take a seat under the mighty oak and sing our songs." Lazarus' poem speaks of the refugees' plight, that their lives bear the scars of anguish branded by a world of sin. These Russian immigrants to America are seeking freedom to love the law that Moses brought, to sing the songs of David, and to think the thoughts of Gabriel to Spinoza taught, freedom to dig the common earth, to drink the universal air. For this they sought, refuge over wave and continent. They sought, as all immigrants to the United States have sought, a place where their inherent worth and dignity would be respected. They sought freedom of religion, economic opportunity, and a safe place to raise their families. In 1883, Emma Lazarus penned the words we have come to think of as symbolic of welcoming immigrants to our country. They were published as The New Colossus. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles, from her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. With Lazarus' sonnet on the pedestal, the Statue of Liberty promises safe harbor here for the homeless, the poor, refugees yearning for freedom. Emma's yoking of statue and immigrants lead to a vision of the statue's mission, and by extension that of America, as the provision of refuge oppressed. Lady Liberty has come to symbolize perhaps some of the United States' best intentions. This appears to be a case of believing that we are something we are actually not. Welcoming of all without regard to race, creed, or national origin. The current rhetoric out of Washington, which has now been going on for 2 years at least, and the views of many U.S. citizens across the country relative to immigration reform show our national psyche for what it really is: fearful of difference. Whether it was a prophetic poem at the time, as Esther Schor suggests in her biography of Lazarus, it seems now to me to be ironic at the very least, and possibly misrepresentative of what the United States is really about. The Lady and the Lamp, named Lady Enlightening the World by its French sculptor, Frederick Auguste Bartholdi, was originally intended to ennoble enlightenment, and the Enlightenment era of the 19th century is deeply entangled in the doctrine of discovery. Let us return to the doctrine of discovery and see how it was used after Pope Alexander VI codified what the European monarchies were already doing. Each of the colonial powers, Spain, France, and Great Britain, acted as if they had discovered the Americas, claiming the land as the king's own possession. All any of them had to do, they felt, was plant the flag of the monarch and give or sell the land to the king's subjects. Christian Europeans traveled to and occupied territories whose inhabitants were considered heathen at best and subhuman savages at worst. To accomplish this, it was necessary to either encourage emigration from the old world to the new world, or exile those considered troublemakers to this supposedly uninhabited, uncivilized wilderness. Possession was 100% of the law under the doctrine of discovery. After the Revolutionary War, when American colonists wrested governance power from the British, they simply continued to operate under the doctrine of discovery, spreading west across the continent, displacing and disseminating tribe after tribe of the Native American nations. Collusion between land speculators and the legal system, including the United States Supreme Court and its justices, continued the practices of colonialism. The doctrine of discovery is at the root of American imperialism and the treatment of indigenous peoples to this day. New scholarship on the doctrine of discovery is providing 21st century Americans with examples of viewpoints and actions that contradicted the 16th and 17th century modus operandi. Not everyone subscribed to the discovery doctrine. Notable among those who chose the more ethical practice of purchasing lands from indigenous peoples are the Dutch West India Company in New Netherland prior to the arrival of the British and subsequent renaming to New York. The Quakers in Pennsylvania, and Roger Williams, whose Royal Charter of Rhode Island issued by Charles II acknowledged the rights of Indians to the land. In the lead up to the UUA's 2012 General Assembly in Phoenix, Arizona, partner organizations working with the Arizona Immigration Ministry asked that UUA member congregations be educated about the doctrine of discovery and to pass a resolution repudiating it. The UUA Board of Trustees sent a report explaining the doctrine of discovery to all congregations, and you can still find this report on the UUA's website, along with many other documents about the doctrine, including the text of the responsive resolution that was adopted at the General Assembly. It reads in part, "Therefore, be it resolved that we, the delegates of the 2012 General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association, repudiate the doctrine of discovery as a relic of colonialism, feudalism, and religious, cultural, and racial biases having no place in the modern-day treatment of indigenous peoples." Subsequent paragraphs of the resolution call upon Unitarian Universalists to review historical theologies and policies and programs to expose the historical reality and impact of the doctrine of discovery and eliminate its presence in the contemporary policies, programs, theologies, and structures of Unitarian Universalism. After self-reflection and self-examination, the work of healing must be engaged. Following a public statement of repudiation, the resolution encourages that the UUA encourage other religious bodies to reject use of the doctrine of discovery in dominating indigenous peoples and collaborate with these groups to propose a specific congressional resolution to repudiate it. We didn't lead the way. Well before we Unitarian Universalists affirmed the 2012 responsive resolution, the Episcopal Church had adopted a resolution officially repudiating the doctrine of discovery in August of 2009. However, our closely aligned cousins in progressive liberal religion, the United Church of Christ, followed suit in 2013 with a nearly unanimous vote to repudiate. And in 2016, having released a study report, the Christian Reformed Church rejected the doctrine as heresy. A group of 500 clergy, many of them UUs, publicly denounced the doctrine of discovery during protests at Standing Rock over the Dakota Access crude oil pipeline in November of 2016. This morning I heard an interview on Krista Tippett's On Being with a Native American poet, and they were talking about the issue that's primary at Standing Rock, which is water. And this poet, whose name I didn't catch, said that water is not a resource. It is the source of life. Efforts to call attention to the legacy of the doctrine are making an impact. It may be that changing the name of a minor federal holiday proceeds city by city, as was the case with the development of Labor Day, until state governments and ultimately the federal government catch up with the people. Engaging in honoring and healing our relationships with Native Americans could show us a way towards righting our relationships with other marginalized and oppressed peoples in this land of freedom and opportunity. We've had such a contradictory history and message towards immigrants. Come settle this land for us, we've said. We need your labor and your skills, we've said. We don't think you should be mistreated, we've said. But then when refugees and asylum seekers arrive asking for protection, for jobs, and for a place to raise their families in peace and safety, we've told them to go home. We've separated children from their parents. We've treated each new wave of immigrants with hostility and disrespect. We've rounded up people on the basis of their ancestry. Our nation's immigration policy is certainly in need of reform. As a country, there is obvious disagreement on the form those reforms need to take. I mentioned Voice last week and that Brew has been involved with this organization from its early days. A key Voice event is coming up on October 21st. It is a 1,200-person action with Governor Northam. There are several issues on the agenda, including keeping families together. The goal is to support immigrant and Muslim families who are in danger of being separated through the deportation of parents away from their citizen children, or through the unfortunate policy known as the Muslim travel ban. Please connect with Robin Feegis about Voice actions. I hope we can listen and hear the stories of separation and work to change the outcomes. We're doing good work here at Brew. There are stories in all of our families, going back decades or going back hundreds of years, that speak of an immigrant experience or of an African American experience or of an indigenous people's experience. Here we have gathered in this land that stretches from sea to shining sea. How good it is for people to dwell together. Would you rise in body or spirit as we sing an English translation of Psalm 133, verse 1, hymn number 392, Hine Matov, in unison. Please join me now in a time of spoken prayer followed by silent meditation. Making ourselves comfortable, settling in, opening our hearts. We lift up these prayers that have been spoken aloud, as well as those that remain unspoken, held in our individual hearts, held by this community. We are grateful for lives that have been lived well and long, for new life that comes even as it comes with challenges. We face challenges in our physical beings, our emotional beings, our spiritual beings. We ask for the support of those around us and that which is greater than all of us, to get through the difficult times, to get through the times when our country seems to be splitting at the seams, a time when we are feeling very deeply the impact of how those who violate others inflict pain and sorrow, and it does not remain there. It ripples out. We need our communities. We need to support each other to get through, to move on, to find a better way and a brighter day, so that we can celebrate the joys of life, the beauty of life, the fun and just pure wonderfulness of what it means to be human, because that is where we really need to be. Please join me now in a time of silence. The benediction I've chosen this morning comes from a volume called Lifting Our Voices. It is by Starhawk. We are all longing to go home to some place we have never been, a place half remembered and half envisioned, we can only catch glimpses of from time to time. Community. Somewhere there are people to whom we can speak with passion without having the words catch in our throats. Somewhere a circle of hands will open to receive us Eyes will light up as we enter. Voices will celebrate with us whenever we come into our own power. Community means strength that joins our strength to do the work that needs to be done. Arms to hold us when we falter. A circle of healing. A circle of friends. Some place where we can be free. We extinguish this chalice, for the worship has ended. Our service begins. Mm-hmm.